Good morning. This meeting is now in session. My name is Angela Ryder, Chair of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy. It is Monday, February 27th, 2023 at 9 a.m., and I'm calling this meeting to order. Folks on this video conference, please mute yourselves until it is your opportunity to speak or you have been called upon to eliminate any distractions of background noise. The Chair of the Arizona State Board of Massage Therapy reserves the right to change order of the items published on this agenda, except for public hearings set for a specific time. During the board meeting and upon a majority of the quorum, the board may go into executive session to obtain legal advice from the board's attorney pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3 on any items listed on the agenda. All meeting attendees whose presence is not required in the executive session may remain in the boardroom while the board withdraws from the two chambers for an executive session. Any and all legal action by board members will only take place in open session. In accordance to open meeting law, the board has a civility policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out its business. Individuals found violating this policy will be asked to modify their behavior and activity, and if the disorderly conduct continues, the person may be removed from the meeting. Director, Mr. Augerton, will you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member Tapscott?
Present.
Board Member DeRoost?
Present.
Vice Chair Moon? Chair Ryder?
Present.
Three present, one absent, one vacant.
Thank you. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.01H, the board may make an open call to the public during a public meeting, subject to a reasonable time. The cutoff time is 2 minutes and will be timed by board staff, placed in manner restrictions to allow individuals to address the public body on any issue within the jurisdiction of the public body. However, board members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action. The board, however, may ask staff to review a matter or it may ask that a matter be put on a future agenda. Be advised, a call to the public is not an opportunity for testimony for cases that are being reviewed by the board and, again, must be within the jurisdiction of the public body. Do we have a call to public? And I see Michelle Cordero, your hand is raised, so please go ahead.
Thank you. Michelle Cordero, Director of Education for ASIS Massage Education. I would like to request that the board issue new provisional licenses similarly to the way renewal licenses are currently being issued, despite massage therapists not being able to obtain a level one fingerprint clearance card. Renewing therapists have gone through the same background process that new applicants would be doing with the FD 258 cards that they are submitting. ARS 32-4222, number 10 states, beginning January 1st, 2023, applicants must possess a valid fingerprint clearance card for initial licensure, license renewal, a temporary license, or license reinstatement pursuant to this chapter. When asked why renewals and initial licensure are being treated differently, I was told that it was illegal to issue new licenses because the clearance cards are not yet available. It is not clear why they are being treated differently. During the November 28th meeting, after both Chairperson Ryder and Board Member Tapscott brought up their concern about preventing people from working, Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan it assured the board and stated, the board may have to issue temporary licenses. People will get their licenses. You're not going to be holding people up. And to that point, as long as you are applying by December 31st and have graduated, you do not fall under that law. If you graduate after December 31st, then you fall under the law. It will just be, as I said, people will have their license. It will just be a matter of how the board goes about doing it, end quote. To address the statement about graduating and applying before December 31st, this is also has not been the case. ASAS currently has 15 alumni who have graduated and applied before December 31st who are stuck in this group to issue new licenses. And during another meeting, the October meeting, Assistant Attorney General Monahan also said, anyone who applies prior to January 1st is fine. if their application is in prior to January 1st. Those after January 1st, that will be something that probably the next board meeting we can address on how the board wants to handle that and in what ways it can. So I request that the board issue provisional licenses to qualify new applicants and remove the barrier that is preventing them from working legally and earning an income as a massage therapist in this state.
Thank you, Michelle. Next hand up is Janet Kuppich. Please go ahead.
Well, I don't know if this is the right forum or if I don't have a statement necessarily to read, but I do have some questions, and I know that you stated that there was no questions to be answered, but I still want them stated to be, researched. If the board is an entity that is to support massage therapists, my question is, what are you doing to help the situation, and is a temporary license something that you can issue? I just graduated in January, and I've already lost a job because of this. It's putting us at extreme economic impact, all of us that graduated. We were heavily sought after as soon as we walked out of graduation. We have lost dozens of jobs at this point because nobody wants to hire us with the pending issuance of our license. And we have done everything that we are supposed to do. And yet I feel like the board is holding our fee hostage and our license and our career and our future, and possibly impacting people, whether they are being evicted from their homes, being able to sustain anything, because we gave up everything in order to do this. And I feel like, as a board, to support the new massage therapist as well as the existing massage therapist is something that is under the guidelines of what the board is there for. And I don't understand, is the federal government saying it is illegal for us to have a temporary license? Because if they're not, then it is the board that is holding us back in Arizona, not the federal government. So I have questions that you are removed from being able to be contacted.
Thank you so much, Janet. Unfortunately, 2 minutes is up, but we do have your questions written down. Next hand up is Noelle Walwerk.
Good morning. I am here to echo what Michelle and Janet are saying. I also am a new massage therapist. I actually moved to Arizona, which is a right-to-work state, and my right to work has been completely taken away. I have also been offered multiple jobs. I was denied the ability to move into an apartment because I cannot prove that I'm working, even though I am educated. I actually do have a level 1 clearance background check, which I've emailed the board about through the state for substitute teaching, because I'm trying to go about finding a job now. It's been almost 2 months since I've been living here without a job. And I have a level 1 clearance background check. And what I was told is that that level 1 clearance does not count as a level 1 clearance for massage therapists, but I'm confused how a background check for being with children could possibly be less than for being a massage therapist. Right now, it's just feeling incredibly frustrating. And like Janet said, eviction, losing jobs, people in the town that I live in Sedona, it's a place where they're wanting to hire new massage therapists. And that's hurting those businesses as well, in a time where we're really needing to be in economic recovery after the last 2 years. And as I said, it is a right-to-work state. And so I'm wanting answers as well. I've asked for a temporary license, especially since we do have the background check. Like, I've been cleared federal and state, so I don't understand why I wouldn't be allowed to work and do the work I was trained to do in an 800-hour program in Oregon. And then coming here, I'm thinking about having to move my whole life back to a different state just so I can work. And so I'm just asking the board to give us some answers, but also issue temporary licenses if we have the background check. I understand the safety is important, and I want to value the safety of all of our clients, but this just feels unreasonable, and I don't, it doesn't.
Thank you, Noelle. Next hand up is Judy Sell. Go ahead and unmute.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you. Hi, I'm Judy Stahl. Good morning, Chair Ryder and Member DeRoost and Member Tapscott and Executive Director Augerton. I have started attending these meetings when I can since the election in November. I've been very busy. I'm a massage therapist here in Arizona. And I know some of the folks who are on this call who've been in the profession for a long time. I just wanted to reintroduce myself. I am one of the people who was a primary mover in the creation of this board. I became a member of this board, appointed back in 2004, and became the chair of the board, so I have a sense of what it's like for you all to be sitting in the seats that you are sitting in, board members. And I want to say that I really appreciate the work that you and Executive Director Augerton are doing to protect the public, which is, of course, the reason for this law in the first place. I appreciate that there are so many different aspects involved in running a board here and being the leaders in the state of Arizona for massage therapy. And I very much appreciate the eagerness of the newly graduated massage therapists to practice. I also know that there are many things that go along with doing this work, and I appreciate the fact that you're willing to take the blows and hear what folks have to say about their concerns. And I'm happy to be present and see how we can all move forward together. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Judy. Next hand up, Berserk.
Yeah, thank you. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, my name's Brett Bigelow, and I graduated from Gateway in January. Was all excited, pumped up to graduate. And then it just feels like the air has been, you know, squished out of me. I mean, it's 13 weeks or something that we're waiting on a license. It's kind of ridiculous. And I know I don't want to blame the board, because I bet you guys are frustrated with the situation as well. But, you know, my wife and I own a spa in Peoria, and I could be making money right now, and it's frustrating because there's bookings that I could be massaging, and it's just, you know, my wife's been a massage therapist since 98, so 20 plus years, and it's just, you know, I got into this business to work alongside her, and we have our studio, and it's just really frustrating. So I hope that you guys will go to bat for us and make some changes, or plead with, you know, the FBI or whoever's holding this up to get it going, because there's, you know, it's starting to affect people's lives, and our, you know, we spend all this money to go to school and take the time for 9 months, and then, you know, we get out and we're sitting here waiting and waiting and waiting. It's just frustrating. So, but I appreciate all you guys, and I'm sure that, you know, it's frustrating for you guys to hear all this and be waiting on, you know, the FBI or the government or whoever's the holdup. But, anyway, just wanted to make my statement. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much. Are there any other calls to public? Glendale manager from Elements Massage, please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Christy Hutchinson. I am the regional manager for several Element Studios here in the Valley. And I just wanted to reiterate the, you know, statements that Michelle Cordero made. And again, I support the safety and the intent of the law. It is becoming increasingly difficult to continue to grow our business with the therapist that we so desperately need. We're just hoping to have some sort of solution in the very near future.
Thank you. And are there, let's see, we have, do we have any other calls to public? Carolyn? and Carolyn also from Elements, or are they the same?
We can go on to Kathleen Massey, who's waiting as well.
Okay. Next is Kathleen. Please go ahead. And I'm not hearing anything. Is anybody else hearing anything?
No.
Okay. Okay. Are there any more calls to public at this time? Okay. We will be moving on to the next agenda item. some of these things that mentioned will be talked about later on in the reports given by the investigator and the executive director. Thank you. Next item on our agenda is the declaration of the board member conflicts of interest. The board members should have had an opportunity to review the board packet for today. Are there any conflicts of interest? And there are not. Next, the board members should have had an opportunity to review the meeting minutes from January 23rd, 2023, and our special meeting on February 6th, 2023. Is there any discussion to be had regarding these open meeting minutes?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
We did not yet provide the February 6th meeting, special meeting minutes to the board because we have not received them from the vendor.
Oh, very good. Then
they'll,
I will.
They'll show up in the next meeting.
I will omit that one. So the meeting minutes only for January 23rd, 2023. Okay. And I move to accept the open meeting minutes from January 23rd, 2023.
And this is Board Member DeRoos, and I'll second that.
And a roll call vote, please, Mr. Overton.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Board Member DeRoos?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moon? Chair Ryder?
Aye.
Three ayes, one absent.
The motion passes. We did originally have Sergeant Jay Stout supposed to be on our agenda today. Unfortunately, he was unable to join us today, and I believe we are trying to get Sergeant Jay Stout from the Organized Crime Section Special Investigations, Mesa Police Department, to join us next month. Is that correct, Mr. Overton?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. We currently do not have any formal interviews or formal hearings today, so we will move right to investigative reviews. And our first case is 23-016, Stephen Hall, who is a revoked licensed massage therapist number 13094. This is a preliminary review of the information available to the board at this time. It is not a hearing. And the board may consider a cease and desist letter and refer the matter to local law enforcement for prosecution. Is Stephen Hall present at this meeting? And it appears that he is not. Investigator David Elson, can you please provide a summary of the complaint against Stephen Hall?
Yes, Madam Chair. On February 15th, 2022, the board received a complaint from KW indicating the respondent was practicing on a revoked license. She also provided numerous text messages where the respondent admits to practicing continually since his revocation. Then on February 16, 2023, the board received another complaint from CR that respondent was practicing on her since his revocation in 2018. He was disciplined the first time in 2013 by where he had a 90-day suspension and was required to take some continuing education and then received his license back. And then again in 18, he did something similar and was revoked by the board and remains in a revoked status. but is obviously continuing to practice. I've reached out to both KM and KW and CR. I'm not sure if they're on the call, but I made them aware of the meeting and said they would be able to testify should they want to.
Thank you, Investigator Elson. Do the board members have any questions for Investigator Elson at this time?
This is Board Member Tashka. Do we have information about what his prior infractions were, why the license was suspended and eventually removed? And, I mean, you know, what the past history was of the actual.
Yeah, I think I included his previous orders in the packet, but the 13, in 2013, he was suspended and made to, based on the findings of fact, that he touched DW's breast and exposed DW's breast and genitals. DW had not requested a breast massage. That was in 13. And then in 18, his findings of fact are, during a massage, respondent massaged RM's breast without her prior written consent. Respondent also uncovered and touched RM's bare vulva. Respondent told RM she was physically attracted, and that he had a history of disciplinary action with the board that may be used as an aggravating factor when determining the level of discipline for any violation. So he was revoked based on those findings of facts in 2018.
Thank you.
Mr. Roos, do you have anything?
Yeah, maybe I missed it, but do we know where he's practicing? Is it with a business or on his own?
On his own.
Okay. And Tony?
I just wanted to comment that the public record for anything, including the Hall case, is out on our website, so anyone that wants to see it on the public can go look at it anytime. You would just do the status tab, and then under status on the right side, there's the disciplinary actions. You just scroll down. It is alphabetical, easy to find.
Thank you.
And I don't think the 13 would be on there because it's over 5 years old, and we're required to take anything over 5 years old off the website.
Correct.
Yes.
I'm going to go ahead with this. Based on the information presented at this meeting and contained in the investigative report, I move to issue a cease and desist order for the practice of massage therapy and defer to local law enforcement.
There's your one of your complainants, AW.
Madam Chair, if you'd like to hear from her, you can absolutely do that right
yes,
now.
Yes, absolutely. I will pause on my motion and take testimony.
Would you like to just rescind the motion? Would that be okay?
Yes, I will rescind my motion at this time for a cease and desist order. KW, please go ahead.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So hopefully, I've never done one of these meetings before, so I don't know if my hand is still raised, but I just wanted to let you know I was here and can provide your testimony. You just want me to go ahead?
Yes, please. Go ahead and provide us your testimony.
Okay. I was referred to Steve Hall from a client who had I'm a Pilates instructor, so my client referred me to him. She had been seeing him for 15 years, and he came to my house February 1st and February 8th, and I had two 90-minute massages from him, and I had then referred him to another one of my clients who texted me pretty shortly after and had told me that she Googled his name, and the first thing that came up under his name was the 2013 complaint, and then she told me that she found the 2018 complaint and that his license was revoked, and so I immediately texted him and asked him if it was him, and I texted my client to see if she had heard about it, which she hadn't, and then we had the text exchange that I provided in my complaint, basically that he had confirmed that it was true, but he didn't agree with the him getting his license taken away, and that he felt like this was his gift, and that he helps people, and that that's why he continued to do it. And I did tell him, I asked him to send me my money back, which he did, and I told him that he needed to be reported, and he said, I beg you not to report me, and I'm done, and then I sent my complaint in.
Thank you very much, KW. Your testimony is greatly appreciated. We appreciate you speaking up.
Thank you.
Based on the information presented at this meeting and contained in the investigative report and the testimony given by KW, I've moved to issue a cease and desist order for the practice of massage therapy for Stephen Hall and defer to local law enforcement.
This is Board Member Tapscott. I'm happy to second that motion. I completely agree with you. I have a question, though, maybe for our attorney, which is, in referring to law enforcement, can we also make recommendations that this be followed up on? This is very egregious, what we're hearing. It's not just when we want to, you know, can the board make a statement about this that encourages this be, the legal action be taken on this?
Yeah, of course you can.
Good. Okay. Chair Ryder, would you be happy to add that kind of to our motion, or should I, or? I think we're all on the same page. I think we all are.
But. Yeah, absolutely. Please make your recommendation. I will, James Monahan, I rescind my current and then redo my motion. So I rescind my current motion of a cease and desist order.
You could just amend, Chair
okay.
Ryder.
All right.
And add that language.
And I will amend. Mr. Tapscott, please go ahead with your recommendation and I will amend that.
Thank you so much. So I motion that we add or amend your motion and that we recommend that law enforcement follow up on this in the strongest way possible.
Thank you.
And you're friendly to that amendment, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay. And then a second. Can we get a second to the amended motion?
I'll go ahead and second that. Motion. This is Board Member Drew.
Thank you.
And can we do a roll call vote, please, Mr. Overton?
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member DeRoost?
Aye.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moon? Chair Ryder?
Aye.
One absent, three ayes.
The motion passes, and that concludes this investigative review.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a footnote for the board members that are at the meeting this morning. It's worthy to know that the state board used to have two field investigators. Those positions were both defunded. So just reminders as we go along what you used to have versus what you currently have.
I appreciate that reminder. Although the board members are aware of this, sometimes the public is not. So I like that reminder. Thank you for that.
And the only information we have on the respondent in that case is 5 years old, 2018. I reached out by voicemail and email and never got a response in regards to this meeting.
Thank you, Investigator Elston. We're going to move on to the next agenda item, and these are going to be license applications requiring board review. First is case number 22-230, Anna Wayne. This is a preliminary review of the information available to the board at this time. It is not a hearing. The board may consider a motion to accept or deny the initial license application for Anna Huang. All parties, please be advised that the board requires you to be on camera, unmuted, as well as your representing counsel. Is the applicant present at this meeting? And it appears not. Investigator David Elson, will you please provide a summary of your investigation of Ms. Huang to the board members and the public?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is actually a bring back.
Yes.
She's already been to one board meeting, and you asked that we reach out again and try to contact her. which I did the first week of February. I sent her an email, a snail mail correspondence, and I tried to call. I haven't heard a response from her. But on June 1st, 2022, she applied for an Arizona licensure by reciprocity based on her NCVTMB certification. On her application, she disclosed that on May 26, 2005, she was arrested for prostitution in Los Angeles, California. Based on this information, the board conducted an investigation. So we found out that she was arrested in 2005, and in 2009, she did a order for expungement to have the prostitution case expunged from her record. But then I've not been able to get in touch with her.
And this is the same individual, again, that you mentioned that we have requested to ask more questions to, and she has not responded.
Correct.
Okay. Board Member Tapscott, do you have anything that you would like to add? Any questions?
I don't have any questions. It just, I feel very hard to oversee people that won't show up to those boards, which is, so I don't know, I'd like to hear from the other board members, but I think this is, we've given ample time for this individual to show.
Agreed. Board Member DeRoos?
Yeah, I think, like in the past, it's something where if we're not hearing from them in honor of kind of keeping it timely, being able to process things timely, I think moving forward and making a decision, especially since enough attempts have been made, I feel good about how many times we have tried to reach out.
Agreed. Would either of you like to create a motion?
This is Board Member Tapscott. I make the motion that we deny the application.
And Investigator Elson, you have your hand raised.
If you look at option one on the report, it kind of gives you a way to deal with her not responding and the fact that the conviction was expunged.
Okay. And we are looking at that right now.
Did you want me to read it for you?
Madam Chair, if you are thinking about denial, then, you know, your denial would be based on the applicant's failure to respond to the board's request to speak to them about this licensure application.
Okay. Mr. Tapscott, make note of that.
On the option is based on information presented at this meeting, findings of fact, statute, and rule violations identified in the investigative report. Upon meeting all licensure requirements and signing a consent agreement for a $500 civil penalty and payment of the civil penalty, grant licensure. If not signed and all requirements met within 30 days or payment of civil penalty not received within 60 days, deny licensure.
Thank you. I would like to invite Board Member Tapscott to repeat his motion.
This is Board Member Tapscott. I make the motion that we deny the license application based on the fact that this individual has chosen not to report in front of the board upon our multiple requests.
And I will second that motion. And a roll call vote, please, Mr. Augerton.
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member DeRoost?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moon? Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
3 ayes, 1 absent.
The motion passes. The license is denied. The next case is 22-259, Xu Wang, applicant. This is a preliminary review of the information available to the board at this time. It is not a hearing. The board may consider a motion to accept or deny the initial application for Xu Wang. All parties be advised that the board requires you to be on camera, unmuted, as well as your represented counsel. Is the applicant present at this meeting?
She was here previously for a couple. This is like the third time it's been back.
Correct, yes. It does appear that Ms. Wang is not here at this time. Investigator David Elson, will you please provide a summary of your investigation once again regarding Ms. Wang to the board members and the public?
October 16, 2022, applicant applied for Arizona massage therapy license. On October 12, Scottsdale Police Investigator Brian Wolf contacted board staff about applicant being licensed. Board staff was advised that I advised him that her status was pending and she was not licensed to practice yet. After the exchange of pictures, Investigator Wolf confirmed the applicant was working at Peaceful Spa or was at Peaceful Spa numerous times. So an investigation was conducted. Ms. Wang did testify before y'all that she was looking to purchase the business, and it was tabled to continue the law enforcement investigation. Since the last meeting, I spoke to Investigator Wolf and received in writing that he has concluded his investigation for now. At this point, no charges have been filed after his meeting with the city prosecutor. So there was no charges ever brought against her.
Thank you, Investigator. Board Member Tapscott, do you have any questions or comments you would like to address at this time?
I did just want to clarify real quickly, Madam Chair, with the investigator. So the the results of that investigation were that they did not conclude that she was practicing without a license or engaged in any prostitution, right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
This is Board Member Tapscott. I think this is the information we've been waiting for, is conclusion of this case. I don't think I can pass judgment on something when no charges have been brought. And I invite input from both of the other board members present here, but I don't have any concerns at this time.
Okay. Board Member DeRoos?
Yeah, I agree. I think that this was the information that we're needing and that we absolutely would need to move forward with issuing a license. I don't feel like we have anything to not do that.
Of course. Thank you. Based on the information at this meeting and contained in the investigative report, upon meeting all the license requirements and properly completing the application with honest and accurate information, I move to grant licensure.
Mm-hmm. This is Board Member DeRoos, and I'll second that.
And a roll call vote, please.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moon? Board Member DeRoos?
Aye.
Chair Ryder?
Aye.
3 ayes, 1 absent.
The motion passes. That concludes this application review. Next is case number 22-210, Tyler Federowitz. I apologize. I am completely mangling your last name. This is a preliminary review of the information available to the board at this time. It is not a hearing. The board may consider a motion to accept or deny the application for Tyler. All parties be advised that the board requires you to be on camera, unmuted, as well as your representing counsel. Is the applicant present at this meeting? And I will take silence as Tyler is not here at the meeting. Investigator David Elson, would you please provide a summary of your investigation?
I assume she was going to be here. I've talked to her several times. I'm not sure where she's at. But on April 28, 2022, applicant applied for initial licensure as a massage therapist. And applicant marked no to the questions. Within 5 years before the date of this application, have you been convicted of a class 4, 5, or 6 felony involving moral turpitude that is reasonably related to the practice of massage therapy? And within 5 years before the date of this application, have you been convicted of a class 1, 2, or 3 felony? A review of the applicant's background revealed that she had been convicted of felony endangerment and DUI on May 11, 2018, within the 5-year time frame. Based on this information, the board conducted an investigation. On May 30th, 2017, she was arrested and charged with felony DUI, felony driving on a suspended license by the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department. On May 11th, 2018, she was convicted of endangerment and misdemeanor DUI, felony endangerment and misdemeanor DUI. Then on April 13th, 2022, applicant falsified her application by marking no to the felony questions. After speaking with her, she thought that because she was charged in 17, but not convicted until 18, that her 5 years started in 17. But because the conviction was almost a year and a half later, that put her within the 5-year time frame.
Thank you, Investigator. Board members, do you have any questions or comments? We'll start with Board Member DeRoost.
Sure. As far as we know, there's not been any other convictions or no other legal
Not as the date, not as of her application date.
That we know. Okay.
Board Member Cap Scott.
Yeah, just for clarification, the felony endangerment is part of the DUI, correct? I don't mean that. I mean they're the same incident, correct?
They're involved in the same incident. Basically, it's because she was. To make a long story short, it's because she was driving on a suspended license and got the DUI at the same time.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
All right. So our board options for this application review would be to have the applicant sign a consent agreement for a $300 civil penalty and payment of civil penalty and grant licensure. If not signed, all license requirements met within the 30 days, or payment of the civil penalty not received within 60 days, deny licensure. I'd like to open up that conversation to the board members for feedback.
This is Board Member Tasca. That seems like a reasonable approach to me to take.
And just to be clear, that's for the falsification of the application, right? Not for the underlying conduct. Okay, thank you.
Correct, yes.
But our other options are we can just accept or deny or this other option, right? So,
yes.
I don't know. I'm okay accepting the license. It was long ago, and there's not been any other, from what I can hear, there's not been any other ongoing issues, so I lean more towards just accepting licensure.
Okay. Would you like to issue a motion that would include meeting the license requirements? And Mr. Tapscott, please.
Sorry, I just want to interject.
Yeah.
I appreciate that sentiment because I feel the same way. I think I'm not sure that I'm concerned about these incidents 5 years ago, but I am concerned about not appearing in front of the board, writing no on the question that was asked, and I think it's good for us to make some statement about that, and a statement through action, and that's why I thought the fine was, you know, a reasonable response to that. that you have falsified your application. We're still willing to give you a license, but you need to pay a fine for that, and we're willing to forego these other things. That was my only thought process there. I completely agree. I love that we are, you know, not holding on to past offenses for too long that don't directly relate and all that kind of stuff. But we're talking about an offense of falsifying the application.
I agree. Mr. Roost?
Yeah, I can see that, but I also can understand being maybe thinking that it happened in 2017. I had to do the math on that when I was like, this feels like it's outside. I can see the argument both ways. She, again, to your point, she's not here to speak to that, but she has been in contact with the investigator, and so it's not like she's not trying to be a part of this. I don't know what's going on, if there's a reason that she couldn't be here. I could go both ways, too. I feel like I need to say that.
Board Member Jerus, you've convinced me. If you'd like to make a motion, I'm with you.
Sure. I will make a motion to accept the licensure based on having everything. I don't know. Is there something that I need to add to that?
You could just say grant licensure based on meeting all requirements.
Okay. I'd like to make a motion to grant the licensure based on meeting all the requirements of the application.
This is Board Member Tapscott. I second that motion.
And Mr. Augerton, roll call vote, please.
Board Member DeRoost?
Aye.
Board Member Tapscott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moon? Chair Ryder?
Aye.
3 ayes, 1 absent.
The motion passes. That concludes this license application review. Next on our agenda is a review of probation status and compliance. This is case number 22-101, Jan Mead. Licensed Massage Therapist 13081. This is a review of a probation status and compliance for case number 22-101, Jan Mead. Is Jan Mead present at this meeting? And Investigator David Elson, would you please provide the board and the public a summary of this case that we are reviewing?
Yes, Madam Chair. In case number 22-101, he was signed a consent agreement for probation of his massage therapy license. And this was based on the findings of fact that was included in the packet. And the order, the way the order was written was that it was issued to respondent to practice as a massage therapist in the state of Delaware, hereby placed on probation for 1 year, subject to the following conditions. 12 hours of continuing education, $300 civil penalty, all of which he completed within the 1 year time frame, and so we removed his probation because it had been well over the year that since he was done. We're just updating y'all on the actions that we took as the board.
Okay, so there's nothing that the board needs to do at this time. The license has been resumed. Is that correct?
I guess just acknowledge that the license has been placed back in active status.
Okay.
Madam Chair, this is AG Seamus Monahan. You could make a motion to ratify board staff's decision to release the respondent from the consent agreement as he has complied with all terms.
Really? could you please repeat that?
you just moved to ratify board staff's decision to terminate the probation.
Okay. I move to ratify the board's decision to reinstate.
Terminate
the probation. May I have
This is board member Tasca. I second that motion.
And a roll call vote, please.
Yes, Madam Chair. Board Member DeRoost?
Aye.
Board Member Tasca?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moon? Chair Ryder?
Aye.
3 ayes, 1 absent.
The motion passes. And Assistant Attorney General, thank you for that guidance. That one was new for me. All right. We have some training that's going to be happening in a moment that will take up a good amount of time. So I would like to request a 10-minute recess before proceeding to that next agenda item.
Yes, and Madam Chair, if you don't mind, if we could take the investigator's report and the executive director's report and then do the training last, that would probably be most appropriate.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Okay. Let's do it that way before we do the 10-minute recess then.
Okay.
Okay. So let's move to Senior Investigator David Elson. Could you please provide the board and the public with your monthly report detailing the current status of submitted administrative case investigations and any other additional information that you would like to add regarding DPS clearance cards, methods, all of that great stuff that inquiring minds want to know?
Okay. So for as far as cases or complaints, we have 10 new cases since the last board meeting, 5 of which were administratively closed by Executive Director Augerton and myself based on the fact they were outside jurisdictional limits. One was cleared up at this board meeting, being Stephen Hall, so that only put us with 4 open since the last board meeting. We processed and cleared 47 sets of fingerprints back from DPS, and we have 57 sets of fingerprints outstanding still with DPS. As far as DPS goes, I don't know if y'all saw the news story on Channel 15 that it's not us holding up licenses. It is the FBI providing DPS the okay to get the level one fingerprint clearance card. We're just as eager as all these people trying to get their license. We're just as eager to give it to them as they are to get it. And that's all I have.
Thank you. Investigator David Alston, I would like to add, and please correct me if I am wrong, which I don't think I am, but maybe you can reiterate, the importance of massage therapists not choosing another profession from the DPS website, such as physical therapy, for their level one clearance card. My understanding from somebody who is a physical therapist is that massage therapists choosing other professions is actually holding up those who are actually physical therapists from getting their license, is because it's backlogged now because they're choosing a profession that's not theirs.
Right. In my dealings with DPS, if they catch somebody that's trying to get a massage therapy clearance card and marking Board of Physical Therapy thinking it's going to get them a clearance card, first of all, we can't accept it because it's going to say Board of Physical Therapy on there. And secondly, the reason the fingerprint clearance card was brought into effect is so that we have a real time way of knowing who's arrested. At this point in time, it's a statute the board has that within 10 days of being arrested or charged, you're supposed to notify the board with any criminal charges. That very seldomly ever happens.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe twice a year somebody will actually report it. But with the new fingerprint clearance card, once you're arrested and charged, the board will be notified in real time. And then if it's been longer than 10 days, then the board has the option to take action against you for not failing to report the charges within 10 days. But if you mark Board of Physical Therapy, our board isn't notified. They'll notify the Board of Physical Therapy that somebody was arrested. And DPS she told me we're actually trying to stop them from marking Board of Physical Therapy and make them wait on the massage board.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Next, Executive Director Thomas Augerton, will you please provide the board and the public with your monthly report at this time?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will probably be a regular feature at every monthly board meeting, but that'll be the update on the database conversion. As everyone here knows, the board was mandated to convert from its existing database to a product known as Centia, and that is true for the other 9010 boards as well. The progress is continuing. We have completed a 60-page questionnaire detailing how licensing is done in the state of Arizona for this industry. That information has been provided to the vendor along with copies of existing documents used, such as the initial license, the renewal application form, the wallet card, and so forth. So they are in the process. They have reportedly migrated the data from the existing database to their product, and it's being manipulated in order for it to be available. And at this point, we meet weekly with the vendors and with a DOA representative known as an engagement manager who basically partners with the board as this process is underway. The completion date is still expected to be the end of the fiscal year, this early summer, midsummer of 2023, as required by the legislature for the 9010 boards. And some boards were ahead of us in line and are actually up and operating and making adjustments. We had requested to be at the end of the line because we were and still are actually under the umbrella of the Arizona Auditor General's Office for the Sunset Performance Audit, which is the next topic. We did file a letter since the last board meeting indicating that in order for us to comply with comprehensive policies and procedures, we are going to need to work with an outside vendor to assemble this information and bring it to the board for review and adoption. And then we targeted December of this year to have this completed. As you also know, the board did appear and testify before the Committees of Reference a few weeks back as part of the Sunset Audit. And this board, along with others, but this board was only given a two-year renewal, which we will require the board to go through another Sunset Performance Audit as this current audit ends in 18 months, and that it will require, again, a formal response to the auditor, a new audit, and then another appearance down the state legislature before the committees of reference to report on the previous audit, which is the one we're currently in, and whatever audit takes place in the 24-month period. Next issue. I know we've discussed this before, but I want to make sure everybody really thoroughly understands it. When the board was created now about 20 years ago, the birthday of the licensee was used as the initial and the end date for the two-year licensing period. However, of course, that in most cases is more than 24 months. Now, one of the formal findings of the Arizona Auditor General is that the board was acting illegally in issuing licenses for a day beyond the 24-month period. And we also received, of course, discussion with the AG's office on the same topic. As a result, we immediately began, I think it's been 2 months ago, maybe 3 months ago now, to only issue a license on a date and then have it expire 24 months from that date. So prospectively, no one is receiving a license on their birth date unless they happen to have applied on their birth date. We also, the staff also went back retroactive roughly about 10 years to bring as much as we could into legal compliance. As a result, there are licensees who received a different notification than what they expected for the renewal date of their license, which had been historically their birth date and now was a new date based on the 24-month requirement. As everybody knows, licensees have the ability to submit a renewal application up to 60 days before expiration, and that is really designed to ensure that nobody is without an active license who is currently licensed and obviously currently working. So the 60 days is more important than perhaps not for those who have got a new renewal date, that once they have their completion of continuing education credits, they can submit their renewal license application. As is on the website, and as has been discussed before, all renewals that are being submitted when they have the proper requirements and the payment are being processed. Now, we're doing this provisionally because we have the legal ability to do so. We do not have the legal ability to do this for initial licenses. We do not have the legal ability to issue temporary licenses. All of this has been vetted since this issue first came up. If you want to look for history of us being the only board to experience this, and by the way, this is a reminder, the Arizona Department of Public Service, Public Safety, rather, submitted their request for the new LMT Level 1 card in June of 2022. So we're now in our eighth month of waiting. Now, in the case of the Occupational Therapy Board, it was a 12-month delay for them. And you may want to use that as a yardstick, because that was the normal processing time that they went through. Again, they did not have the ability to issue temporary or provisional initial licenses as well, and it was a hardship for the people that were entering that industry at that time. So if you are renewing, you submit as normally. It's processed as normally. When the Level 1 card becomes available, it is a current legal requirement. Again, I defer to our assistant AG to correct or edit as I'm giving you this verbally, but it still will be a requirement even though you have a renewed license, and you will need, when the Level 1 card becomes available, to apply for that. The delay typically is not like the inked fingerprint process that's done for the National Criminal Background Check, which takes 3 months. DPS ordinarily processes the Level 1 cards very promptly. I think recent examples have been 2, 3, 4 weeks. There may be a bottleneck as all of the people waiting for an initial license are submitting their application for the Level 1 card along with those who have been renewed already. And remember, if we have 11,000 licensees, every calendar year you're looking at roughly half that number having to renew their license through the process. So we are doing what we can with the renewals, but the requirement will still be there. And worst case, if you don't provide the Level 1 card to the board in the calendar year after it becomes available, you will have to provide it at the time of renewal, which would be the 24-month window on the back end. On the initial, of course, as soon as the card becomes available and it's applied for, it should be scanned and returned to the board in order for the bottleneck that currently is lining up to be processed. So the only good news, if there is any good news from this whole experience, is that anybody applying after January the 1st already had a 3-month delay to get the SB 258 Federal Fingerprint Inked card processed. So the damage, per se, would not begin happening for this year's applicants until April the 1st. For individuals who applied in the fourth quarter of the previous calendar year, they are the beginning of the queue or the line waiting for licensing this year. So I'm hoping everybody, as best I have explained that, understands item number C with regard to two-year licenses under the report issued by the Auditor General and the advice of the Chief's Office is, in fact, 24 months. The last issue is the actual process, and I think we've covered this before, but it may be good to emphasize this, that there were many, many components for a person looking for an Arizona initial massage industry license. But the best way, and really the only way to begin the process, is the completion and the submission of an initial state license application form, because that is the legal affidavit which attests to the information that's being submitted is, in fact, correct and truthful. And then, obviously, the form cannot be submitted until the state treasurer has been paid. So the licensing fee, which does not come to the state board, it goes through the Arizona Department of Administration and to the state treasurer. There really is nothing at the state board until those two things have taken place. So it is not helpful to send an inked fingerprint card in advance or have a school transcript mailed to the board. There's no file opened, and everything is, of course, based on physical record, even though it's digital. Many of the forms come to us as physical scans. It is not helpful to send anything to the state board before the submission of the application or the payment of the fee. And, in fact, we return items to the applicant if they're given before the application has been received. Now, if you apply online digitally, it is almost instantaneous because once you hit send, it becomes part of the board electronic record and then it begins being processed by the staff after payment verification is confirmed. The problem with mailing is, in fact, that anything that comes to the board office doesn't just come from the U.S. Postal Service to the board office. It goes through three state of Arizona mail rooms before it gets to us, so there is an operational delay between the time the person puts something at the post office and the time it's received at the board. And that's just bureaucracy. That is the vetting process by which mail is received. It goes through security scans and so forth. So the same thing, really, with dropping it in the lobby of the building. It's received in the building, but it still does have to be security scanned and processed between two mail rooms before it physically gets to the board office. So the state of Arizona made a decision years ago to do digital licensing, and that is the primary way that people get their industry license. I can give another little bit of good news, that when CENTIA becomes operational, the relationship between an applicant and the status of their application will be a lot more immediate, and it will be a lot more responsive in terms of status reports. That is status quo in most states around the country. It's status quo for those other state boards that utilize other software products. And again, not as a complaint, but as a reminder, we're using software that was developed in 2010, 13 years ago, on a laptop that has no reporting ability whatsoever. If you ask me a question, I cannot give you, the staff cannot give you any specific answer to your analysis request. When CENTIA is available, that will be very different. The other thing, too, we've had discussions here before, and I am advised by CENTIA in our meetings that for the first time, the state board may actually be able to communicate directly with the current state licensee database. So, for example, during COVID, unless somebody went to the state board website, they would have no way of knowing that the renewal fee was waived for 2 years, that we waived the CE requirements for 2 years. It is just almost unthinkable that a regulatory office doesn't have the ability to communicate in real time to its licensee database. So that is something which will have capability. I'm not proposing, an unnecessary monthly newsletter to the industry folks out there, but I do think, given the last 2-3 years of experience, including legislation, there is enough happening in the world of a licensee that they would benefit from knowing sooner than later, and also on a consistent across-the-board basis if their license is maintained in active status. So if you have any questions on any of the subcategories I tried to cover, but it has not been good. It is not currently good. It is getting better. But remember, you're not dealing with, corporate America here. You're dealing with a 90-10 board where 10% of your licensing fee comes off the top to go to the state treasurer's office, and the remainder is used. And, in fact, your industry currently has a $1.4 million balance in your revolving fund. But for the last 4 years, despite my charm, I have not been able to get one more dollar or one more FTE for licensing. And as we sit here today, you have one licensing person and an assistant, and you have one investigator and no more field investigators. So some good news, some sobering news, but that is what's going on.
Thank you, Mr. Augerton. And Board Member Tapscott, I'll get to you in just a second. I just had something on my brain that I wanted to mention after Tom had discussed. People will be more informed if they are compelled to visit the board website on a regular basis and to attend the meetings, although sometimes the information can be a little, not as exciting. Change the address. Change your address on the board website so that you are getting your postcard to indicate when your renewal is coming up. Now that the date has been changed from the birth date to, something different. And if all else fails, well, first of all, too, let me say, there is no way to speed up the process. The board can't speed up the process with these initial licenses. We want to, of course. But when all else fails and you can't get that information, you can always tag board member Tapscott or I on social media, and And we'll try to answer those questions. Please, go ahead, Board Member Capscott.
Thank you. Executive Director Augustin, just want to follow up on some of the stuff. I just want to clarify some of the stuff you said. It sounds like Centea will be a welcome improvement for some of the issues we've had. And you said it should give us feedback on an application as to items submitted. Is that correct? Like it'll say, in theory, it should say we've received your transcript or we haven't. We've received your fingerprint card or we haven't, right. That kind of thing.
Right. Cool. Madam Chair, Board Member Tapscott, yeah, what the board currently does, which is antiquated and mostly frustrating to the applicant, is you get a deficiency report. And, I mean, I personally would have called it an inventory report because if you put everything in, here's an inventory confirmation. But it's called a deficiency report historically, and there may be things that are missing, and that's provided to the person. Under Centea, as each thing is received, there'll be a confirmation email to the applicant. I think the sense of communication will be improved, not by increasing the staff, but by increasing the software. So yeah. There is a benefit.
Yeah, thank you. By the way, I hear and agree with you loud and clear that there is money available, and it would be in the best interest of the public, in my opinion, for the safety of the public, if we had more investigators and more staff in your office. And I actually appreciate you reminding us all of that. One more question. On the 2-year renewal, which makes perfect sense to me, licenses can't be renewed for more than 2 years, but I don't understand why we retroactively went back and changed them, because once you've set a birth date, isn't it 2 years after every, isn't the mistake already done and done 10 years ago, so to speak? Does that make sense? And then they are being renewed every 2 years?
Madam Chair, Board Member Tapscott, one interpretation, which was my initial interpretation, was to be prospective. But the audit findings were so significant in failures by the board, which I would argue is based on resources, but they would argue on the objective criteria, that there is a need for correction. To be complicit in an ongoing practice without correcting it doesn't demonstrate to the Auditor General who reports to the Arizona Legislature that your regulatory staff, who is funded by the Arizona Legislature, is listening attentively. So a lot of what we do is not only for compliance, but the appearance of credible cooperation and a relationship with the people that keep us doing the job properly for the public. So that there is, I think there's an expectation of full and faithful compliance to a sunset performance audit, particularly when they're coming on 24-month intervals. Because really, if there's no legislation in 2 years, you will not have a regulatory board. So it's in any director's best interest to try to show that there is, within the existing resources available, that there is an attempt for full compliance with the findings that the state has come up with against the board.
Thank you. That makes perfect sense to me. And I would agree, once again, this is a resource issue. But thank you. Thank you for your clarification.
Board Member DeRoos, do you have any questions or comments at this time?
I don't. Thanks.
All right. Let us now take a 10-minute recess, and when we come back, we will resume with our annual board member training with the amazing Assistant Attorney General, Seamus Monahan.
Thank you. See you in 10.
We are back in session. It is Monday, February 27th at 10:24 a.m., and next on our meeting agenda is the annual board member training presented by Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. Appreciate you indulging me today. This is going to be, you know, kind of a 35,000-foot training. We're going to go over everything. Please refrain from any hypotheticals. You won't see me getting into too many either, just because it's really hard to, try to game plan for what issues may look like because you see so many different ones. But if you have any specific questions after, you can reach out to Executive Director Augustin or myself and send me those questions. If you have any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But as we're going along, if something doesn't make sense or I'm not explaining it thoroughly enough, just let me know, okay? All right. And can everybody see it now?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. All right, let's get started. So these are practical tips for new and veteran board members. I would consider you all, you know, not novices anymore. You've been here long enough. So this presentation consists of two primary elements, directives based on state law and recommendations derived from years of practical experience representing state licensing boards and other people in my office who have helped to provide some information here. So just as an introduction, administrative law is not for sissies, so you should lean back, clutch the sides of your chairs, and steel yourselves. Much of the work of state boards is governed by state laws, for example, the open meeting law, conflicts of interest, and public records laws. Where state law does not prescribe the board's conduct, some basic elements of parliamentary procedure can be useful in conducting board meetings. And you know those are parliamentary procedures is usually covered under Robert's rules. And this board, I would say, does a good job about deferring to one another, making sure that, you know, everybody's getting a chance to talk. You're not talking over each other. That's really cohesive and, you know, allows everybody to understand why the board's making their decisions. The parliamentary procedures are guidelines for conducting meetings and making group decisions that cover such issues as making motions, discussing matters, and voting. Maybe informal or formal procedure, but must not violate state law, such as, you know, starting a meeting before 9 a.m. when it's scheduled for 9. No one is to disturb another in a speech by hissing, coughing, spitting, speaking, or whispering to another, nor stand up or interrupt him. As I said before, this board does an excellent job, all the board members, of allowing each other to talk, not talking over one another, allowing everybody's voices to really be heard on every matter. Robert's Rules of Order is one but not the only formal system of parliamentary procedure. Most state agencies follow general rules of parliamentary procedure. State statutes trump parliamentary procedure always. The object is to assist an assembly to accomplish the work for which it was designed in the best possible manner. Again, as I stated, facilitates the board's carrying out statutory duties, establishes a process that enables everyone to be heard, provides fairness and maintains order, makes meetings more efficient, helps create an adequate record of the meeting. And that last one is extremely important, as these meetings are all virtual. And the only way for the public to understand what happened at that meeting afterwards is to review that audio. And if that audio isn't clear and you're talking over one another, then you don't have a sufficient record. Again, if a matter comes up on appeal in a judicial review action or to Superior Court, in those instances, you're going to want to have a really clear record of what happened in each case. During the meeting, some general functions of the board chair. So maintains order in the meeting, does not do all the talking, does vote, encourages participation, helps equalize participation, prompts comments if necessary, clarifies or rephrases if necessary. And as I said already, this board, you do an excellent job of that. And Madam Chair, you yourself do an excellent job of keeping everything on task and very clear and delineated. Again, assist the board in staying on task, redirects members or speakers when necessary, presides over a formal hearing, assists in creating a clear and adequate record of the meeting. Again, you're going to hear that a lot because one of the most important things that you can do is create a clear and adequate record. That's important for open meeting law as well, but it's important, as I said, for the public to understand what and why you're doing what you're doing and to be able to refer back to that audio. Describing the chairman's job, Speaker of the House Tom Foley said, there is a degree to which you could sort of push, encourage, support, direct, but the speakership isn't a dictatorship. And even though this is not the chair is not a speakership, it is technically. The meeting should start on the time specified on the agenda if a quorum is present. Do not start the meeting before the time on the listed agenda, even if a quorum is present, which, you know, we've never had that issue before. So when a quorum of members is present, the chair calls the meeting to order using words such as, I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Pharmacy to order or Board of Massage Therapy. Today is June 1st, 2015, and the time is 9 a.m. Board members who cannot attend a meeting should notify staff in advance. If a quorum cannot participate, the meeting will be canceled or postponed. If a quorum is not present at the designated start time, the chair or other members should announce the board is waiting for a quorum. And this is important too. If you think that you're going to have a conflict on a matter, we will lose quorum most likely if all members aren't present. So if you're going to have a conflict on an upcoming matter, at a board meeting, it's important to let staff know ahead of time because you don't want the respondent or the applicant showing up at the meeting prepared to present whatever they need to and discuss with the board if the board knows that it's not going to have a quorum to discuss that issue. It's just it's a fairness matter. No quorum equals no meeting. If you lose quorum in the middle of a meeting, the meeting immediately ceases. Nothing can be done after that. If you want to restart the meeting, you have to re-notice and wait 24 hours and put out an agenda before you can resume that meeting. I've only had that happen once in the entire time I've been here, but it can happen in a medical emergency or, you know, if a member of the board has a family emergency or just has to leave the meeting. Best practice is to have the chair or a staff member call the roll to identify the members who are present. Sometimes you'll hear other boards, they'll say, well, so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so is all present. You know, the board members are present. And then you got to back them up and say, okay, well, how about everybody put that on the record again? Because for that record, for the minutes, you're always going to want to be identifying who's speaking and who's at the meeting. So if desired, the chair may ask staff members and board counsel to introduce themselves. Each person should be recognized by the chair before speaking. Avoid side conversations and whispering to each other. And luckily, because we are virtual, it's a little bit hard to have side conversations and whisper to each other. Only one person speaks at a time. Do not interrupt another speaker. Do not talk over each other. Again, you guys are great at that. So, dealing with disruptions, the public has the right to attend and to take photographs and audio record or video record, but may not disrupt the meeting. Do not permit members of the audience to shout out. Have a call to the public on the agenda to allow members of the audience to address the board in an orderly manner. And since this board has been seated, you know, I would have to say that, you know, we have rarely had any public disruptions, and in fact the public and the industry members and the people who have been on our calls have been exceptionally well behaved and respectful, and so that, you know, I do thank them for that, because that does help. You know, this board has experienced disruptions in the past, sometimes during the hearing of cases, sometimes just during board business, and it can make things very difficult for everybody involved, so I do appreciate that. If any person is so disruptive that the board cannot conduct business, ask him or her to sit down, be quiet, etc. If she or he does not do so, give a warning that she or he will be asked to leave. They continue to be disruptive, ask them to leave. If necessary, contact Capitol Police. Again, we are, I don't think Capitol Police is actually around anymore. I think it's DPS that actually has those specific duties now. But because we are virtual, it is not necessarily something that we have to worry about. But if the board ever does go back to in-person meetings, it's something to think about. And if there's ever going to be an issue where you feel unsafe, you can always reach out to Tom and say, I understand this matter is on the board. Would you mind requesting a DPS officer for the meeting? Anticipating possible disruption or danger. If the border staff have reason to believe that a member of the public is going to be there, may be disruptive or dangerous, you just contact DPS and, you know, ask if they will either do a threat assessment or if they will be at the meeting for the meeting. The chair should announce each agenda item by name and number. For example, agenda item 3, motion for rehearing, filed by John Doe. Don't just say next item. Again, for the record, helps people who are on the video or on the call. I know sometimes that Tony puts the agenda item up on the call, on the video, which helps a lot. But again, it just helps everybody to understand if they pop into the meeting, they know where the board's at during that part of the meeting. The chair may take items out of order on the agenda if appropriate. No vote is necessary. You're very well versed in that. You guys often do that. We did that today. So indicate that the possibility on the agenda by including a phrase, such as the chair may take items out of order, which is on your agenda. There's a timed item. You may not hear that item before the scheduled time, but you can hear it at any time after. So if there's a hearing set for 9 a.m., you can't hold it at 8:58 or 8:59, but you can hold it any time after 9 a.m. in a reasonable amount of time after 9 a.m., which your complaint notices of hearing always state that it may be held within a reasonable time after the stated time on the complaint notice of hearing. General guidelines for board members. Speak loudly and clearly. Again, not an issue for you guys. I seem to always be able to hear you. Do not mumble. Do not talk into your papers or your hands. The audience in the back of the room or on their computer should be able to hear you. Use surnames, not first names, or respondent. Formal proceedings, public perception. You know, it's very important that when people come before this board, whether they're an applicant or their respondent, this is usually one of the most important days of their life, or as far as their life is going right now. And so for them to understand that, you know, to get the feeling that you care as well and that you're taking the matter seriously, it's very important for that, for the whole process. Don't eat during a board meeting. Apart from possible conversations with board staff or council, avoid talking about board business on restroom breaks and lunch breaks, whether in the meeting room, hallway, elevator, stairwell, restaurant, etc., or calling one another. Just make sure that any conversation that involves board business is done during the board meeting on the open record. The only exception to that is legal advice or, for your purposes, maybe confidential matters, or, you know, legal direction on a matter that's either being appealed or going to negotiations. That would be the only time that questions and information would not be provided on the record. Always be respectful, avoid offhand remarks, sarcasm, inappropriate humor, treat people with dignity and respect, don't belittle them. You know, don't browbeat them over an issue. If, you know, you've made it clear on the record your stance on the issue and gotten a response, you know, move on to the next issue. Pay attention and act like you're paying attention. So again, that just goes back to, as you know, people get very nervous coming before the board. It's a very important day in their life. And so, just to show them that respect and to show them that you care, you know, hopefully as much as they do, that's a very important aspect of the job that you're doing as a citizen judiciary. Turn off cell phones or for emergencies, put them on vibrate. Do not talk on a cell phone during the meeting. Step outside. Do not read or send emails or text messages during the meeting. Licensees and the public place great weight on what board members do and say at meetings. If you wouldn't want a remark to be posted on the internet, in the newspaper, read aloud in court or church, or heard by your mother, then don't say it. As you know, what we say on the record in these meetings will be most likely held in perpetuity based on the recording in the minutes. Some cases are difficult to decide. Accept that and carry on. Don't abstain. Don't pass. Do not postpone deciding a case merely because it is difficult to decide. Sometimes you need to table or postpone matters merely to have somebody show up so you can speak to them. But again, do not postpone them simply because you don't want to make a determination on the matter. Sometimes the only evidence in a case is he said, she said, and as you know, at this board, we don't use that phrase. It's this board's job to determine who they believe is more, it's their job to determine who they believe is more believable in that situation. And so while, you know, a case may absolutely, you may not have evidence and it may come down to a he said, she said, the majority of these cases, it is your duty to attempt to make a decision, whether that is to take action or not. And I don't think that this board has had an issue with that since it's been seated. You've been very decisive and very consistent in your actions when it comes to respondents and complaints. Accept that and make a decision based on your best judgment of credibility. Board members' familiarity with certain factors can make the meeting more effective. For example, the board's powers and duties as set forth in the statute, what actions the board may take at each stage of the proceeding, grounds for discipline, qualifications for licensure. and again, we've had a lot of discussions on those. You know, the board has all its non-disciplinary options available at the initial review. After a formal interview, it has everything except for suspension over 12 months and revocation in its toolkit. And then if it wants to revoke or suspend for more than 12 months, you go to a formal hearing. Again, this board is not new to that. You have had plenty of formal hearings since you've been seated. Be familiar with the board statutes and rules, particularly those that pertain to discipline and qualifications for licensure. It's helpful for each board member to have access to the board statutes and rules at every meeting. Generally, a licensing board's primary duty is to protect the public. Licensing agencies usually have two essential functions: to license applicants who demonstrate that they meet the qualifications for licensure, and to regulate licensees by receiving complaints, investigating the allegations, and resolving the complaints according to law. So, again, it's the licensing and regulations of individuals, and there's licensing and regulations and adjudication of complaints. Those are your two main duties. Public officials may not violate the plain terms of a statute because, in their opinion, better results will be obtained by doing so. They have but one duty, and that is to enforce the law as it is written. We've had plenty of discussions about that. The board does not have the authority to operate outside its statutory requirements, duties, and powers. And if the effect of their action is disastrous, the responsibility is upon the legislature and not upon them. But if they knowingly, even though with the best intentions in the world, violate the law, they and their bondsmen must take the consequences. So again, that just goes back to the board does not write its statutes and rules. The legislature does. It's handed down to the board, and the board is required to exercise that authority consistent with what the legislature has told it to do. The board resolves complaints at public meetings. It is important to know the stage of the proceeding because the licensee has certain entitlements at different stages, and the board's options vary according to the stage. Now, that's not a question of what you can do. That's a question of what due process rights are afforded to the respondent at each stage. Be familiar with what actions the board can take at each stage. Varies according to board statutes. First case discussion, dismiss, letter of concern, request further investigation. Again, like I said, if you're at formal interview, discipline such as suspension up to 12 months, probation with terms, censure, etc. And then again, if you're thinking of revocation or suspension over 12 months, then you would go to a formal hearing. Whether you're at a formal interview, an informal interview, or you are at a formal hearing, after the board has made its decision, the respondent will always have the right to motion for a review or rehearing of that decision. Be familiar with the grounds for discipline, especially what constitutes unprofessional conduct. And again, that's just knowing your statutes and rules. And if you have any specific questions about them and how they work, please ask me. I know you haven't been shy in the past. Licensees are entitled to have the board make decisions based solely on the facts presented in the case at hand. The facts are derived from information and documents provided by the complainant, the licensee, staff investigator, and possibly a professional consultant. And what that really speaks to is don't do any of your own research. Everything that you're deciding the case upon should be brought to you by the executive director and the investigator. And most likely in all your cases, it will be the investigator because that's his duty. So don't look online. Even if you want to check the disciplinary history or, you know, look up somebody that there's a case about in the board's website to see, you know, what kind of disciplinary history they have. Please do not do that. Just keep your determination specifically to the facts that are presented to you by the board. And if you feel that there's facts that, you know, that you can't connect the dots, that there's things that are missing, then as you know, you can always request to have that matter continued for investigative purposes. And you can direct the investigator to get certain documentation. Individual board members should not go out and do their own investigation or research, as we just discussed. It may disqualify the member from participating and jeopardize the board's decision. Again, one of the things you need to think about is that no one board member should have more information than another. And that's not just on complaints. That's on any board business. That's why you don't discuss board business with individuals that aren't on the board. Again, you know, there's that fine line. If you are, you know, Angela Ryder or Michael Tapscott, industry member representing yourself as a very knowledgeable industry member, then that's fine. But just make sure that outside of a meeting, you're never presenting yourself as part of the board. Board meeting professional members may apply their own experience and training, which we would expect you to. That is why, especially the industry members, you were put on the board. You know, our other members were put on the board because of their expertise in other areas. And so, you know, it really behooves you to make your point heard at each meeting because you were put on here specifically for that. When you're resolving complaints, do not refer to or ask questions about previous board actions against the licensee unless and until the board determines that a violation has occurred in the case at hand. The fact that a licensee has a history of discipline is relevant only to the penalty and not whether the allegations in the present case are true or not. So much like a, think of this as a sentencing phase of a criminal prosecution. The prosecution already determines that, let's say, a murder was committed. So that murder was committed, and then after that person is found guilty, then they move to the sentencing phase. And so you should think of that time at the sentencing phase is just like the criminal court. That's when you can bring in other action that's been taken against the board and the respondent. The point is that you're not making a determination on the case at hand based on anything that happened prior to. If you believe that in the case in front of you, that the conduct is so egregious that it requires discipline, then after you determine that and you make a motion for the findings of fact and conclusions of law, then you move on to, okay, now we're going to impose discipline. Are there any priors, right? That would be the time that you look at those, but not before. And that's another reason why you don't want to look at the board's website to look at someone's disciplinary history before they come before the board, because that may taint your decision as to whether they committed a violation in this case. To stay focused on the case, board members may wish to ask themselves, what are the specific factual allegations? What's the conduct? What information is needed to decide whether those allegations are true? Is it the presence of the complainant or the victim? Is it the, is it a police report in which the respondent has admitted that these things happen? So what is the information that you aren't seeing? And again, that's why I am there and I work with David as well to make sure that you do have the right information when the cases come to you. Again, three, do I have that information or do I need more? What information is credible and persuasive? If the allegations are true, what penalty is appropriate? And as you notice, again, the penalty is the last thing you think about. After you've already determined the allegations and the violations of law, then what penalties do we then go to? Well, each case is different. Facts vary. Licensees have very disciplinary histories, strive to issue consistent discipline when the facts allow. I think that this board's been very consistent and very decisive, again, as I stated before, when it comes to adjudicating complaints against individuals. And because you have acted so decisively, you've noticed that you've seen a lot less complaints coming forward recently. And, you know, I can't tell you why that is. I have a few opinions. Maybe it's because there's not as many repeat offenders. There could be a lot of different reasons for that. But it's definitely been seen that the number of complaints has gone down recently. Consistency in decision-making is critical. Need to avoid challenges that decision-making was arbitrary, capricious, or an abuse of discretion. So you just want to make sure that you're basing everything on the facts and that you're basing it on the options that you have, the violations that you have, and the discipline that you're allowed to give out. When a board member asks a question of a person appearing before the board, make sure the response answers the question asked. For example, did you give Ms. Jones a copy of her records? Why wouldn't I give her the records? Again, so this doesn't answer your question. So what you want to do in that situation is respectfully redirect the individual and ask them to answer your specific question. When you ask a question, people are nervous, so they'll start to give you the entire backstory around what happened with that question. So just to make sure that you let them understand, you've reviewed the materials, and if they could just stick to specifically the questions that you're asking, and that you understand their story, you understand everything that happened around that complaint. Another example, when did you arrive at the office on June 8th? I usually arrive by 9. That's a non-answer. You would want to know exactly on June 8th what time they arrived so that you can verify that fact. Because in a complaint notice to hearing or in an order, you're not going to want to have clarifying statements such as, I usually arrive by 9 a.m. You're going to want to actually pin those individuals down, especially if time is important in that matter. Applications. Be familiar with the specific requirements for licensure. Varies according to the board's statutes. Look at the statutes and rules during the meeting. Unless there is a statute permitting the board to waive a requirement for licensure, then it cannot be waived. And we've kind of discussed that today. Unless otherwise provided by law, the board acts by a majority vote of the quorum. Taking action requires a motion, a second, and an affirmative vote of the majority of the quorum. This board generally does roll call votes. That's a great practice, especially since you are virtually, for the record. There are 6 general steps in completing a motion. 1, making the motion. 2, seconding the motion. 3, repeating the motion for clarity. 4, discussing the motion. 5, voting. 6, announcing the result of the vote. And again, this is for the public and for the record. Discussion may precede a motion. The chair asks, do I have a motion or is there a motion? Only one motion at a time. The best practice is that the chair does not make a motion or second them. However, for a small board like this board, it may be necessary for the chair to do so. So I don't want you to get too worked up about that. I have noticed that Madam Chair has been including the other board members in making motions, which I think is a great practice. And on the motions, you know, and this board does a good job, but whenever you have a motion on the floor and it's seconded, remember that at that point, you know, you are only discussing that motion and the facts surrounding that motion. So if the board then wants to, you know, have a discussion with somebody, or I've seen often, you know, the board will make a motion and then they want to have more discussion with the respondent. At that time, what you're going to want to do is rescind that motion, take a step back, and have those discussions again with the complainant, the respondent, and then at that time, you're going to come back and make that motion again. So you never want to leave a motion on the floor and then just kind of move on to other things. You want to make sure that you deal with that motion, and if you don't want to vote on it, then just rescind it and then go back to having discussion with the individuals before you. After being recognized by the chair, make a motion by saying, I move that, or I make a motion that. Example, I move that the board grant John Doe's application for licensure. Do not say, I motion that. Do not simply say, so moved, or things like, I move the committee recommendation. So you really want to be clear. You are making the motion. The following types of statements are not motions. I'm thinking about, I suggest that, I recommend that, I want to. And what helps is, you know, if someone makes a motion like that, that nobody seconds it, right? We just hold on, let's clarify that before somebody actually seconds that. Is that the motion you want to make? And I know it gets difficult because a lot of what you do up there is using the same kind of statements and phrases over and over and over again. And a lot of it feels like a mouthful. A lot of it feels perfunctory. So I completely understand that. But again, it's all about creating that record and just making it very simple for people to tell what you're doing. A specific person, board member, or staff should be designated to write down each motion as it is made. Ask the maker to repeat or clarify the motion if it is incomplete, unclear, or nonsensical. Making adequate motion is the board's responsibility. Do not expect staff to clean up a nonsensical or incomplete motion after the meeting. And then there's always the question that, you know, if the motion is, you know, so without that it actually isn't a motion, it could leave the board open to an appeal by the individual who is subject to that motion. An adequate motion uses clear and understandable language. I move that we issue a letter of concern. The concern is that the licensee failed to respond to the board's subpoena before the deadline. Without waiting to be recognized, another member seconds the motion by saying second, or I second the motion. Again, you guys are getting very, very good at that. Without a second, again, the motion dies. The chair or other designated person should repeat the motion. For example, it has been moved by Ms. Gray and seconded by Mr. Brown that we grant John Doe's license application. A more formal style of procedure requires a motion and a second before discussion. Informally, many boards permit discussion before a motion is made in order to help members formulate a motion. And you guys do that all the time. You're doing it today when you were each asking what the other board members, you know, really thought about the issue, which is great. And please feel free to continue to do that. I think it helps you make a better decision, and I think it helps to inform the public on why you're making that decision. After the second, the chair calls for discussion. If the matter has not already been discussed, is there any discussion? Stay focused on the allegations at hand. Avoid drifting to other topics. For example, if the allegation is that the licensee violated a particular board rule, then discuss the evidence that supports or contradicts the violation. Discussion of whether the rule is a good rule or not is irrelevant. If the board wants to review its rules, put that on a future agenda. And I think we've actually had that discussion. You know, it's not prudent to try to affect or change board policy through specific cases. It's much better to do it more globally and have a discussion about exactly what the board has issue with or thinks is good about the rule or what they want to change. It is helpful if each board member begins his or her comments by stating, I speak against the motion, I speak in favor of the motion. Let all members who wish to speak have a turn first before any member speaks for a second time. Again, you guys do a great job at that. Board members should not interrupt each other. They should wait their turn. Repeat. Do not interrupt. Interruptions can make for an unclear record and can cause confusion. And I know I sound like a broken record, no pun intended, but the record is the most important thing. Board members should feel free to express respectful disagreement, which I think you do very well. If one or more board members habitually dominates the discussion, the chair may wish to vary the order in which members are called on. For example, start at the end of the table and move right one time, and the next time start at the middle and move left. You know, that's if you're in person. But again, I think you guys do a very good job of it. Board members should read the board materials in advance so they are prepared to discuss the matters on the agenda. You know, it's painfully obvious when board members have not prepared, or when they're preparing in real time. And again, just as we discussed, this is, you know, you need to be fully prepared in order to make an adequate motion, which means understanding all the material. And again, you know, to show the respect and dignity to the people who are before this board for, you know, application or complaint matters. It's often very obvious when board members are unprepared. Every member need not comment on every case, but there should be some discussion before a vote is taken. If imposing a penalty, one or more members should explain why that penalty is more appropriate than some other penalty. And every once in a while, you will have a respondent who comes in with, you know, outside material. Let's say it's a Practice Act issue, and it's a cupping issue, and they come in with a scientific article or medical article on, you know, the benefits of cupping that specifically refute the complaint. The board is going to want to consider that material and put on the record, you know, why they agree with that material or why they think that material doesn't speak to exactly, you know, what the issue is. But whenever a respondent brings in material to refute a complaint, the board should always discuss that material on the record and explain why they think that material either is important or is not valid to the discussion. Voting. After discussion, the chair calls for the vote. Vote may be made by a group voice vote or roll call. This board always does roll call, which is a good practice, especially being virtual. For some boards, roll call is required. Again, so if you're imposing discipline, you know, you're always, you know, if you're suspending a license, revoking a license, you're always going to want to do a roll call vote. For non-disciplinary matters, it's not as important, but when you are taking discipline, you do have to have a roll call vote. Oops, sorry about that. No anonymous votes or secret ballots. No voting by proxy. So again, that would be discussing this matter with board members outside of the board meeting, which again, we're not going to do. And please don't reach out to a member and say, hey, this is how I was going to vote. You know, could you vote for me? Repeat the motion again immediately before the vote. Chair asks all those in favor and then all those opposed and then anyone abstaining. Chair announces results of the vote. Motion passes unanimously. Motion passes 4-3. Motion fails, etc. Some board members permit the chair to vote only in the event of a tie. There's no legal justification for that limitation. And as you know, Madam Chair, often votes and creates motions, which is absolutely fine. A tie vote means that the motion fails. The chair may ask for a new motion. If one or more members participates by telephone, board members, staff, and others should identify themselves when they speak. So again, you know, just for the record, this is Madam Chair. Vote allowed by roll call if you're on the phone or virtually. Recusals. So this is kind of where we're going to get into conflicts, and this is very important. As Tom brought up at the committee hearings, where the board was given a 2-year extension, conflicts of interest with this board and with other boards was a big issue, and not necessarily anything specific, just that, the committees were concerned about conflicts of interest, and they wanted to make sure that all the boards are being very out in the open and transparent about those conflicts. So, again, if you have specific questions about a conflict you may have, feel free to reach out to Tom or myself before the board meeting, and we can discuss that. But to recuse means to remove oneself from participation to avoid a conflict of interest or other impermissible circumstances. The recused member is disqualified on that matter. No discussion, no vote, no nothing. And if you're in person, you would leave the table. If you're not in person, you can just, it may be prudent to just shut off your camera. And if you're going to recuse, you need to make sure that you are not reviewing the materials or that you let staff know ahead of time so that they do not provide you those materials. So a recused member should leave the table. Recusal is mandatory for statutory conflicts of interest and for bias, prejudice, and prejudgment. And bias, prejudice, and prejudgment, we'll talk a little bit about more, but that's just you feel so strongly about a case that you know that there's no way you can be impartial and fair in your decision-making. So I've actually never seen that come up. Maybe there's been times when board members felt that way, but they've never said anything. So, that's just something to keep in mind. And then statutory conflicts of interest are really going to be your substantial interests, which are, a family member or yourself has a financial, direct or indirect financial interest in a decision or the subject of the decision is, someone who's a family member or you have a financial interest. In those situations, recusal is always going to be mandatory, but no one's going to tell you that you need to do that. So you need to put all your conflicts down, make sure that staff has a list of all your conflicts. If at a meeting you are conflicted and you have to recuse yourself, that you fill out that sheet from that day stating what that conflict is. That way that you're not hearing those matters and not discussing those matters. And, the common thing I'm going to say to you is, I can't tell you whether you should, I can't make you recuse, right? That's up to you. It's a personal decision, but it carries very, very, very strong implications and potential penalties if you don't recuse. By law, board members who have a conflict of interest under the Arizona Conflict of Interest Statutes, that's your statutory conflict, that's a substantial interest. They must recuse themselves from discussion and voting. Consult the board's attorney for advice before the meeting begins. Conflicts of interest are generally not going to be appropriate for legal advice for executive session, as they're not necessarily board matters. It is a individual board members issue. So again, just consult us and we can discuss the issue with you. Now, the penalties for violating conflict of interest laws include criminal prosecution, being held civilly liable. And in those, when you violate a conflict of interest law, you're technically acting in bad faith. And so in that situation, the Attorney General's office likely would not represent you. You'd be required to go out and pay for your own attorney. It would be a private matter. Substantial interest in a board decision, as we discussed. So a board member who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any decision by the board has a conflict of interest. Interest must be disclosed, and board member is disqualified from participating in any manner in that decision. A substantial interest means any pecuniary or proprietary interest, either direct or indirect, other a remote interest. And a remote interest is going to be anything that isn't defined as a substantial interest. in the statutes. Relative is defined as the spouse, child, parent, grandparent, sibling, or in-law of the board member. Disqualification is mandatory when a board member has a statutory conflict of interest. At the time the agenda item is called, the board member with the conflict of interest should immediately ask to be recognized and then announce the recusal. For example, Madam Chair, I recuse myself on this matter because I have a conflict of interest. And I would maybe even go one step further and just vaguely state what that conflict is, right? This is a family member, I work with this individual if you don't feel comfortable in that situation, right? So you can just vaguely state what the nature of that conflict is. And then, again, you'll follow up with that sheet, which is a public record, which will have more specific information about your conflict. To make clear that the member is recused and to avoid temptation, he or she should leave the board table and sit in the audience. No gesturing, grimacing, shrugging, sighing, shaking of the head, etc. from the back of the room. Circumstances that effectively hinder or prevent a board member from deciding a matter fairly on the basis of its own circumstances is impermissible. Again, as we talked about, bias, prejudice, prejudgment, and these are going to be a little more attenuated fact-based analysis as opposed to, really looking at the statutes and understanding if you have a conflict or not. Now, when we're talking about bias, prejudice, and predetermination, board members should disqualify themselves from discussion and voting if they have strong feelings about the facts of a matter in dispute that will influence their opinions regardless of the evidence. And again, that can be, I was surfing the internet and an article popped up about an individual that we have is a massage therapist who committed some egregious conduct. And I saw the article. I have extra information now that other board members may not. And, there's no way that I could be impartial or fair in this situation. So that could be a situation where you would maybe say, I'm not going to hear this matter. But I would also caution you that I would not use bias, prejudice, and predetermination as a way to excuse myself from having to make hard decisions. Again, these are situations in which you know that your impartiality has been corrupted and you're not able to hear this matter fairly. So, again, a board member who disqualifies himself on the basis should announce his non-participation or her non-participation immediately when the matter is called and should leave the table. For example, Ms. Chairwoman, I will not be participating in this matter. And again, if you are recusing yourself voluntarily from a matter, you don't necessarily have to say that you don't feel that you could, be fair and impartial. You can simply say, I'm just going to recuse myself from this matter. Even if a board member believes that he has no actual or she has no actual bias or prejudice about specific facts in a particular case, they should consider the appearance of fairness and disqualify themselves if participation may give the appearance of impropriety. Appearance of impropriety is a more of a vague statement. Like we talked about, the public needs to have faith in the board, faith that the board is following its statutes and rules appropriately and making determinations on specific cases specifically based on its authority and those facts that are presented. And so if it appears that a member is not, that is where the appearance of impropriety comes in. The following circumstances alone generally do not constitute an appearance of impropriety, and board members should not recuse: being acquainted with the licensee, being a member of the same professional association as the licensee, serving on committees with the licensee. To abstain means the board member declines to vote. In the absence of a reason for mandatory recusal or a genuine appearance of impropriety, board members have a duty to decide matters that come before them. For example, members should not abstain merely because a matter is controversial, difficult to decide or involves a particular person or issue. You know, this board handles, I'd say almost 100% of the time, very, very, very difficult and meaningful cases. And the members do a very good job of not abstaining and, you know, wading into that fray and protecting public health and safety. So, without praising you too much, I think that you do a very good job on this. So, board members may not use their membership to attain any valuable thing or valuable benefit that would not ordinarily accrue to the board member in the performance of their duties. If such a thing or benefit is of such character as to manifest a substantial and improper influence upon him or her with respect to their duties. So that could be, you know, gifts, you know, gratuities, taking you out to dinner, different things like that. So again, just don't take anything of benefit, from anybody who has business or may have business before this board, or a respondent or applicant. Call the public or public comment is permitted, but is not required. It's a good idea to include because it gives the public an opportunity to be heard on any matter within the board's jurisdiction. As you saw today, there was a lot of good discussion on the call to the public, and it helps to keep the board informed as to what the public is feeling, as well as the board being able to adequately address the public's needs. So that is always appreciated when people show up. The board may establish a reasonable time limit for each speaker, 5 minutes, for example, apply the time limit consistently. Different boards do everything. Some do 2 minutes, some do 3 minutes. I have seen only a few who do 5, but it's really up to the board. If the board imposes a time limit, make sure a designated person keeps time. Each speaker must identify himself or herself before speaking. The minutes must include the names of the speakers as given. Unless the matter is separately listed on the agenda, board members may not comment on, discuss, ask questions about, or vote on matters raised and called to the public, except to ask staff to review the matter after the matter be placed on a future agenda or respond to criticism made by a person who addressed the board. But this is very limited. Usually the board does not address those unless it needs to put it on a later agenda. No more than one or two board members should respond to criticism because multiple responses amount to a discussion, which is prohibited for matters not specifically listed on the agenda. To inform the public of the limitation on call to the public, it's a good idea to have a notice on the agenda, such as action taken as a result of public comment will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or to place the matter on a future agenda, which your agendas do have. Executive session, gathering of a quorum for which the public is excluded and which is authorized by ARS, permitted only in the 7 circumstances listed in the open meeting law. Again, the 3 that you are going to use are going to relate to legal advice, discussion of matters made confidential by law, and discussion of negotiation and potential litigation tactics with your attorney. So those are the 3 that you will use. There's 4 other, but they usually never come in. Well, I guess there is 1 more, and that would be in the instance that you need to discuss an employee's performance. That would be the 4th one that you use. But the specific type of executive session must be listed on the agenda. If you notice, the general legal advice is listed at the top on the notice of the agenda, and then the actual potential confidential material is listed under each specific agenda item. It can't be agendized generally. It has to be under a specific item. And again, as we discussed, executive session is the only time when your board business is going to be done not on the public record in front of the public pursuant to open meeting law. It requires a vote. Again, you're going to vote to say, you know, on this agenda item, you know, agenda item 6, we move to go into executive sessions for the purposes of receiving legal advice from the board's attorney. Or we go into executive session on item 1 to discuss records that are made confidential specifically by law. And then once you're in executive session, of course, you say minutes of and discussion held in executive session must be kept confidential. That is your little Las Vegas. So that is where you keep all those discussions. The only people who may be present are individuals whose presence is reasonably necessary in order for the board to carry out its executive session responsibilities. For this board, usually it's a board member, the executive director, and you and myself. Ask all of the persons to leave the room and take their briefcases, purses, laptops, etc. with them. We do those in executive session, so we move into a breakout room. One thing that's always good to keep into consideration is that somebody monitor the regular call to make sure that the executive session is not being streamed into the regular call. It does happen from time to time. Avoid roving discussions in executive session, no straw polls, voting, and generally no consensus. That's the time for you to request legal advice and discuss potential elements of that legal advice as it relates to your case. However, the majority in all discussion regarding the matter, especially deliberations and decision-making, need to occur on the record in open meeting, not in executive session. If the board's attorney is not present, the board cannot go into executive session for legal advice. That's just kind of obvious. Board members' discussion on the underlying matter must occur in public session. So as this board always does, when you exit executive session, you go out and you have a thorough discussion on the record about why you're making the decision that you're making. No voting in executive session. Conclusion of executive session, chair announces that executive session is ended. Again, there is always the caveats, which the caveat to executive session is if you go into executive session to discuss someone's protected health information, maybe it's a respondent or an applicant, the board can discuss that matter in executive session with the individual, just the health-related issues, and then make a decision as to what they will do on that case, and then you will go out into open session and say direct board staff to take action as discussed in executive session. And that's simply because there's just matters that are protected and personal to people. And so if it's legally required, the board is going to do their best to protect your rights. So that's really what that comes down to. And you let the public back in the room before proceeding with public session. But again, we leave, they stay. So that doesn't really apply here. After executive session and public session, do not reveal your attorney's legal advice for any other information from the executive session. That's just, that's again just common sense. The legal privilege that we hold together is gone if that information is revealed to the public after the executive session. So this means avoiding statements such as based on our attorney's advice or Seamus said. A temporary break from the meeting is called a recess. Ending the meeting at its conclusion is called adjournment. If the board takes a comfort break or lunch break, the chair should announce a recess and state the duration of the recess. For example, the board will recess for 10 minutes or we will take a recess until 1 p.m. The other thing that I wanted to note about executive session, which, I'm sure we've discussed, but I just wanted to reiterate, when we go into executive session for the purpose of legal advice, that is simply for the board to receive legal direction on, what its options are, what its legal rights, duties, powers, and obligations to the people are. So it is then the board who comes out and makes those decisions. So as you know, as the board, I never tell you what to do. I just give you the legal layout, and then the board takes that information, and they make the decision based on that legal framework. So I just want to make it clear for anybody who is a board member that I'm never telling you what you have to do. I'm more just guiding you and letting you make those decisions. To provide the board legal, my job, to provide the board legal advice, to ensure the board complies with statutes and rules, to ensure meetings are conducted in compliance with the open meeting law, to conduct formal hearings pursuant to statute and notions of fairness and due process. The AAG's job, oh, well, here it is not to hamper or impede board business, but help guarantee it is done lawfully. The AAG does not direct policy. And I know that can be a point of consternation between what is legal and what is policy, but it is not my purview to advise on policy. It is the board's decision to make those policy decisions. When advice is given during a board meeting, it is for the protection of the board, legal counsel to the board, not to individual members, and not counsel to staff. So that's also very important. The AAG represents the board as a whole, not the staff, not any individual board member, but the body itself. So, in conclusion, be prepared, be fair, and you know what? I think you're already doing a great job. And that's it. And I'll take my phone number off there.
You don't want me calling you? That wasn't very painful at all.
Hey, it took me less than 2 hours. Usually I was talking fast for you, so I hope that was helpful for you.
It was. It really was. It was very informative. There was a few things on there that they were a good reminder, so I appreciate that.
Okay, excellent. Well, my pleasure, and it was a joy.
Board members, do you have any questions or comments for Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan regarding his presentation? Very good. All right, then we will move on to our next agenda item, number 13. This will be regarding board action items for future state board meeting agendas. So I know that at our last meeting, I had also wanted more discussion regarding certification versus licensure requirements, in particular when it comes to reciprocity applications. But my understanding is that we've not been able to obtain the information needed to continue the discussion further. So I would like to continue to add that to the next agenda and hopefully be able to get some of the information needed to continue that discussion. Board Member Tapscott, do you have anything that you would like to add to a future board meeting agenda?
Yeah, in light of some of the call to the public today, I would recommend we add to the agenda what can be done about this loophole we are caught in with not being able to get. And I realize the board can't do anything, but let me just give one example without going into discussion, which is, we can recommend to lawmakers or to the governor that some temporary, you know, something is done. And I would also recommend that we do that in a, I don't really call it an interim meeting, that we don't wait a month to do that, that we schedule an emergency meeting for that purpose to discuss that, like next week, because it has been quite a while. And this could go on, we don't know for how long. We are affecting businesses in Arizona and employees in Arizona.
Perhaps we could put a statement together of something that includes some steps to take and maybe add it to the website. Maybe. Just a suggestion. I don't know if that's something that we can do.
But with all due respect, though, I'm suggesting that we also might want to come out publicly and say something to lawmakers about an interim decision or something, that this would have to be discussed in some meeting. And that there's a sense of urgency to it.
Understood.
No. Thank you. I don't have anything to add. I will make a statement. I appreciate you bringing that up, because I do feel like, Mr. Tapscott, that our hands are tied, but, you know, what can we do? And I'm listening to everybody. I just want to say I appreciate the call to public. I'm not a massage therapist. And so just assuming that I know everything that's going on. It's what I hear in these meetings a lot of the times, and so it is really important to hear those things. And I can imagine the impact that this has had on people, but it was powerful, and so I don't want it to come across that we are not listening or that we're not hearing them. I'm not sure what we can do, but if there is any kind of discussion to be had on that, I'm open to that.
Very good. Board staff, anything else that we need to be aware of before we adjourn this meeting?
Madam Chair, I don't think I have anything else to offer you or the members. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Our next regularly scheduled state board meeting date is Monday, March 27th, 2023 at 9 a.m. to be held digitally. Board members and board staff, public, thank you for being so participatory, Tori. In this meeting, we had a lot of people on the call today expressing interest in the industry, and it is greatly appreciated. So thank you all for your attention and time. Have a good day. This meeting is adjourned.